What's up? Another episode of Ripple Effect Podcast. I'm your host, Ricky Verandas. Today we have blogger, author, activist, David Swanson. He's written books like War is a Lie, When the World Outlawed War, and War No More. And as you can probably guess, we talk a lot about war and geopolitics and foreign policy and all topics that I love talking about because I think these conversations are so important to help inform people on what's going on in the world and all the conflicts and messes the U.S. has made and caused. So please, like I always tell you guys, please, if you can't help on Patreon, support the show. If you don't want to go through the trouble of rating the show or writing a review, then just retweet the show. Share it on your social media sites, wherever you're on social media. Just put it up there and help spread these conversations and help spread just this information, because I think that we can all agree on wanting to end these wars. And David did call in using video. So like I always tell you guys, if a guest calls in using video on our YouTube channel, which is RVTheory6, it's also my Twitter handle and my Instagram name, or you can search on Google or whatever search engine you use, the Ripple Effect Podcast, and you'll find our YouTube channel and our websites and everywhere you can find the podcast. But on our YouTube channel, you'll be able to see me and the guests visually have the conversation. You'll be able to visually see us have the conversation is what I meant to say. And in the show description, you'll find links to the guests' websites, their social media, and all that stuff. So if you're a fan of what they're saying, if you want to support the guests, if you want to just get more information, then go on our YouTube channel, find the episode or the guest that you like, and just go down in the show description. You'll find all their links to their YouTube channel, their websites, and all that stuff. So that's it, I think, for now. So enjoy the show. It was a really fun conversation. David Swanson's a very intelligent, well-spoken, passionate activist and author who I think, if you're not familiar with him, you'll probably be a fan of his after you hear this episode. So enjoy the show, guys, and I'll see you on the next one. Peace. David.
Hello, how are you?
Hey, good. Thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Not a problem.
You hear me good?
Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks for being with me. A huge fan. I remember the first time I saw War Was a Lie, it reminded me of another book that I love, War Is a Racket by Smedley Butler. And the title just kind of got my attention. And it's funny because, you know, and I'm getting right into it, as you can tell, because I know your time's a little limited. But it's funny because it seems like, you know, when you were being an activist and when you were really getting involved politically, that, and even when I was first getting involved politically, that one thing I always liked about the left, liberals, was that they seemed, I didn't know too much about policy or economics, but I understood war, and I understood war was bad. So to me, it was easy to pick a team because I was growing up during the Bush era where it's like, what is this guy doing? I mean, he's a criminal. I mean, we're going into unjust wars. People are dying and there's no justification for it. It was easy to dislike him and pick the other side. And it seems like more and more things are transitioning where, you know, I've had people on like Scott Horton, who's very outspoken against war, and a lot of libertarians and people, you know, that type of thinking seem to be almost more outspoken than people on the left. Do you think that's, why is that? Why do you think people are finally seeing through the BS of left and right, and it doesn't really matter who's in power, the Henry Kissingers, the Brzezinskis, everybody's still influencing policy, and it, you know, the right left thing is just something made up, so we have all this internal arguing, but at the end of the day, foreign policy never really changes.
Well, I don't know that there's been any study of people on the left and on the right to see who was more outspoken. Certainly people on the left that I hang out with can talk at high volume without taking a breath for several hours. I wouldn't imagine anyone else was more outspoken. I think who you hear more from depends on media outlets and forums for hearing from them. I'm sorry?
I didn't mean to cut you off, but there was like a hissing. Did you hear that?
I did.
Yeah, I don't know. Was that you or me? I don't know which feed it was. Well, it went away, so I guess you can continue. Sorry.
I mean, I think, you have to form uncomfortably large coalitions with people who agree on particular things. So if somebody's against war for some reason that strikes me as crazy, but they're against war and they disagree with me on 1,800 other things, I still want to stand with them against war. And certainly that's the case with libertarians. They aren't in favor of war. Great, let's, amplify that message. But, they don't get much play in the corporate media, the big media, and certainly nobody on the left does. If anything, libertarians are more acceptable to corporate powers than leftists, but they get play in their own media outlets, and we need to build those and expand them.
I think that's an important point, because I think one thing that I love, and you worked with him, Dennis Kucinich, and when he was with Ron Paul, how it was funny because they came together on so many issues, even though their philosophies might be completely different on many other things, they came together on the really important issues. And I thought that people didn't talk about that enough, how important it was to realize that, let's not do what the media wants us to do and what basically, those in power want us to do, and that's fight over all the things we disagree on, but let's focus on the things we do agree on, and the fact that there's a lot of, and I think this is probably something that you can use to kind of relate with anybody all over the world, is that we probably have more in common with people that we think we have nothing in common with, like somebody from the Middle East or somebody from, Eastern Europe or whatnot. We have much more in common than we think we do. And most people just want a safe environment. They want peace. They want, a safe place for their kids to grow up and to play and a job that pays a decent wage where they can make a living and support their family. And going back to Ron Paul and Dennis, I thought that more people should have talked about that, how important it was for people to come together and really put all our resources together to fight the things we do agree on, like you fight for, anti-war.
For sure, I agree. But it can't be a compromise because, you can't say, let's have a left-right coalition that says take $500 billion out of the military and put $250 billion into tax cuts and the other $250 into the things the most people want, education, green energy, et cetera, because the libertarians won't stand for that. It's against their principles. They can't be in favor of spending a dime on anything, even if it means spending $250 billion less than before. They won't touch it. So it has to be the libertarian position of, let's just take $250 billion out of the military and put it into tax cuts. And maybe we could try to make some of them for working people so they aren't all tax cuts for Donald Trump and his friends. But that's it. And then so you have to get on board with that position, the people on the left who really, really want to spend the money on green energy instead of on war in hopes of both preventing nuclear apocalypse and preventing climate apocalypse, because they don't really want to die in either scenario, So it's tricky to form these coalitions. But I mean, at the local level, of course, left and right, you can come together around anti-war actions, and we ought to. And most people don't identify as left or libertarian or anything at all. They identify as sports fans and TV viewers and shoppers and so forth. And those people also agree with all of us to a great extent. I mean, have a long ways to go. But if we had just, rule by referendum, democratic votes, we would be slashing the military. We would be investing in good things. We would be closing all the foreign bases. We would be ending all the wars. We wouldn't be going as far as I want immediately. But by stages, we would, because as you scale back the military and the rest of the world scales back their militaries and you create a reverse arms race, then going further looks more reasonable to more people. But we have to get that started.
Yeah, well, I think we could scale back a lot, before anybody else had to, and we'd still be way beyond everybody else. Because I mean, people can just Google there's about a dozen graphs where you can see military and defense spending of the U.S. and the next nine countries, and we spend more than the next nine countries, and that includes huge countries like Russia and China. And it seems like it doesn't matter who's in power. You know, Trump, everybody thought that he was going to be the chosen one who's going to change things, and defense spending goes up. Defense spending goes up, and we're the biggest arms trader seller in the world, and the taxpayers get screwed because we buy all, you know, we spend all this money on developing, you know, weapons we don't end up using or jets we don't end up using, and then get more weapons and jets and bombs. And then if we don't use them, we end up selling them. So then, you know, everybody's making money except the taxpayer. They're the ones who are getting screwed at the end of the whole negotiation.
Well, I like the ones that don't get used and the ones that don't work and the ones that malfunction, you know, better than the ones that do work and the ones that get used. But I'm against all of them. But just a couple minor linguistic points. I don't call it defense spending because it's not defensive. And I don't think we should push their propaganda unless it's, you know, naming the official name of a department of the government or something.
Because, well, it used to be called Department of War, and then they changed it, right?
For sure, yes. You, by all means, call it the former Department of War because it is a Department of War. And call them war contractors and call them, you know, merchants of death and military spenders and profiteers off wars. But don't call them defenders, defense industries, because then people think they're being defended. And they aren't. They're being endangered. The more you spend, the more bases, the more wars, the more provocations, the more weapons dealing, the less safe you are, not the more safe, you know. So it is, you know, it's not even that we have to scale back and find that proper balance where they're just keeping us safe but not doing things that go a little overboard. No, it's all endangering us rather than protecting us. It's you know, provoking and creating enemies rather than generating friends and allies. I also don't use the first person for this stuff because I'm really not doing it. I'm doing everything I can to stop it. So, you know, we can say, you know, we sell more weapons than anybody else on Earth, but yeah. I don't. I spend a lot of time trying to get people to divest money from those weapons, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, you know, that's a huge issue. I do it myself. Sometimes I say we, and then it's like, well, I'm not involved in this. I'm actually trying to fight against it. You know, when I say we, it sounds
well,
like
you, every single other person on Earth. I mean, I'm the only person who doesn't. But I just and I understand the argument from the other side. It's our government. We have to be responsible for our governments. You know, many people pay taxes to the government. Yeah, but I think there's an argument also for thinking of ourselves as opposed to that industry and not putting the Pentagon in the first person when we went to jail protesting what it was doing. We don't do that with state governments or local governments, just as we don't worship local or state or international flags. It's only at the level of a military that we talk that way.
Yeah, and you know, it was funny because I remember during the Iraq War and after September 11th, they did a great job of convincing people that if you were anti-war, you were anti the troops. And it was this. It was so conflicting in ideas that I'm like, how is anybody not seeing that the most pro-troops thing you could be is anti-war, because you're basically saying that you don't want anybody dying unless it's a necessary last resort. Like, to me, like, the fact that people would bring up, and it seemed, you know, at that time a lot of people were outspoken politically, and you'd be at a bar or a restaurant and people would bring up politics. Next thing you know, this guy was pro-war, pro-troops, and this guy was anti-war, and for some reason people believed that he was anti-troops. And I'm like, no, man, you guys are on the same team. And the person who is for the troops should also be anti-war. Like, doesn't that seem like a really interesting, I guess, propaganda campaign to kind of convince people that, like, hey, you can be pro-war and pro-troops?
Well, it's the troopism, the pro-troops nonsense is very powerful and effective propaganda, and they've done very well with it. But, you know, it's laughably incoherent. I mean, you've had times when polls were being taken of active duty troops engaged in a war, for example, the one in Iraq, where the majority of the troops wanted the war ended and the troops brought home. So the troops were anti-troops, right? And at the same time that we're being called anti-troop for supporting the very same agenda that the majority of the troops support in polls, we're being told that we have to support bills in Congress for more money for the troops, even though the money doesn't go to the troops. You know, and I proposed with some of these bills, I did calculations how many millions of dollars each troop would get if the money actually went to the troops, and what people think that troop would do if given the option of, you know, staying in the war or just taking that money and hitting the road. I think the war would be over very quickly. So it's, you know, it's nonsense. And because it's nonsense, it's very effective because people can mean what they want by it. And you can get people to say it who are against the war but are somehow for the troops. Oh, I'm pro-troops. And then you can get other people who hear that as, I'm pro-war. And so we have to get some clarity about what we're saying. I'm pro-humanity. I'm pro-human beings, and troops are included in that, you know, but I'm not pro-troops in terms of giving them the first place in line and the best seats on the airplane and thanking them for their service. They aren't doing us a service. They're endangering us, committing crimes, committing murder, torturing, destroying the environment, eroding our rights. They don't deserve thanks. They deserve apologies. They deserve health care. They deserve job opportunities and training. They deserve good lives. The majority of people enlist because they didn't have better options. This is what they say. So give them better options. I mean, that's how I would be pro-humanity.
Yeah, well, they purposely go to poor areas to recruit kids, and it's sad because it's kids who are, you know, I know Marines, veterans who will never let their kids sign up because they're like, they'll promise you everything and then things aren't as good as it seems. And the other thing too is that they'll sign you up during a peacetime, or I guess the U.S. is never really in peacetimes, but it's, which is another amazing thing, is how many conflicts were involved. And I know in past interviews you've talked about, you know, during the Obama administration, eight wars going on at once, and nobody being able to name any of them. And I think that's kind of a theme with the, you know, I just said this on a past podcast recently, that we're like this weird version, this mild version of North Korea, where we live in this country and we go to work and we do our common routines and we do all the, you know, we have our kids we have to worry about and cutting the grass and paying the bills, and we can be in war and it doesn't affect us and we don't see it on the news like they do internationally. I was born in Portugal and I still have a lot of, most of my family still in Europe, and they know much more about what's going on with the conflicts that the U.S. are involved in than people from the U.S. And it's amazing how isolated we are from what's going on in the world. And really, I mean, even just history. I mean, it's you know, they know more about the fall of the Ottoman Empire and you know, how the Western powers carved up the Middle East and created a lot of the issues that are going on today, and all the coups we were involved with in Iran and in Central America and all this stuff. And you know, and then you go to school in America and they just want to talk about, you know, Lincoln and George Washington. And not that those things aren't important, but it doesn't give you the whole picture, and it's this kind of molding people to become nationalistic and patriotic. And I think that it's a, you know, and putting your hand on your chest and all this stuff. And I know you're a father like I am, and it scares me because it's like, you know, you want them to, you're basically brainwashing kids at a young age to be patriotic and to do things without thinking about it and the consequences. And I know you also have a philosophy background. You've studied philosophy. Another question I've always been kind of intrigued with was, do you think a world without war could exist?
Yes, of course. This is the point of the organization I'm the director of called World Beyond War, which you can go read about at worldbeyondwar.org. You know, war has not existed in most places at most times in the 10 or 12,000 years since it was first created in a form completely unrecognizable from what it is now. I mean, it's been sporadic through human history. It's been non-existent through most of the existence of the modern human species. It's been abolished in countries and remained abolished for centuries. It's been created in countries and lasted for centuries. You know, but nobody has ever had war that looked like it does now, with these weapons, this level of destructiveness and this level of risk of total destructiveness. Nobody has ever had an empire like the current U.S. empire of bases and ships and planes with the ability to get and strike anywhere with assistance from satellites in space. And nobody has ever spent the level of resources, funding on war that the United States does. But you look at the other 96% of humanity, if you want an example of people with governments that spend dramatically less than the United States on war and engage in war in most cases dramatically less, every other country on Earth is closer to the $0 spent by Costa Rica or Iceland or countries with no military than to the $1 trillion spent each year by the United States. And I imagine if you go to Portugal, like most countries, and you show them, you know, U.S. kindergartens and children pledging fascist pledges to obey flags every morning and saluting and being kicked off the football team if they don't engage in flag worship during a national anthem and being told they should be fired from a professional football team by the president of the United States. You know, that this sort of extreme nationalism would strike most people in most countries as absurd and outrageous. And then the mission that goes with it, that this, you know, condescending superiority of we have a mission to dominate the rest of the globe for its own benefit, is offensive to most people around the world.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's why I say we're this mild version of North Korea, where it seems like everybody else sees it except us. And I think that's the power of propaganda. I think that's the power of, Edward Bernays understanding that most of our decisions weren't made by logical conclusions we came up with. And it's scary because, we do live in a world where now we have so much access to information. You know, when the internet was first kind of becoming, when news on TV was basically being trumped by news on the internet, social media, that's where people were getting their news, it seemed like that was a good thing. But now it's almost gone to the point where there's so much so many websites and so many different people you can get your news from online, that now people are just kind of overwhelmed, that it's like, well, now I don't know what to believe, because I could almost find a conflicting opinion on every story. And I talk to people sometimes and they're just like, there's just too much. I don't know, because I read this and then I read that, and then, you know, I can share this article and then this person will share that article. And it's like, you know, there is no, it's hard to find a truth if there is one in a story. And there's all these conflicting reports, and I almost feel like it works in the benefit of creating people who just are overwhelmed. They're like, you know what, I've had enough. I can't control anything. Let me just go on with my everyday life, and I'm just overwhelmed with not knowing what's fake news and, you know, and whatnot. And it's the fake news meme, you know, I think it's gone to the point where it's overused. People will just use it on anything they disagree with. And because you can find a conflicting report, you could almost call anything fake news.
Well, of course, you can call anything fake news. Doesn't make it fake news, but it might be. And I think you're right that this is a problem for a lot of people. People raise their hands at the end of events and ask about this. Which news should I find? How do I find out what's true? And they don't have a clue how, you know, because I think a lot of people used to turn to big corporate news. And once the internet was developed, again, most people went to big corporate news organizations' websites, which is a major problem and remains a major problem. But then things started slipping in through social media and otherwise, so that people were getting other viewpoints, other forms of news. And now that's being discouraged. It's being people are being encouraged to think of non-corporate news as unreliable in every case and as corrupt. The threat to internet neutrality threatens to worsen this incredibly. We already don't have Facebook neutrality. You know, Facebook and Google and these companies already determine, for the most part, what people are likely to see, with a heavy bias toward the biggest corporate and government-friendly news. And so people have to learn where to look and what to shut out and how to judge and how to find original sources. I mean, don't read an article that says that a White House memo said this and another article that said the White House memo said that and try to tell who's more credible and who's lying. Read the stupid White House memo on the White House website. Don't read somebody else's report on it. Watch videos of what's happening in Yemen. Don't go to ABC or CBS and have them tell you what they saw in a video from Yemen. You know, go to the original when and where you can. Often it requires no more time, no more investment than going to secondary and third sources. And go to sources that build up credibility in your eyes and in the eyes of those you trust, not sources that have the most money. And give a preference to sources that are outside the country that the news is about. You know, don't look for U.S. news about Russia, but look for Russian news about the U.S. I mean, don't look for U.S. news about the U.S. Go to British and German and Korean and Russian news about the U.S. And if you want news about Russia, don't look in Russia. Then you can look, you know, in sources outside that country and learn to judge. And yeah, it's a little bit of work, but you know, it's not as hard as surviving in the world that's rapidly being created, which is, you know, an apocalyptic scenario.
Oh, absolutely. I completely agree. I do that all the time. It's funny when the whole Russian gate thing was booming up and everybody was talking about, could Russia be involved with these email leaks? But nobody was actually talking about what was in the emails. I'm like, isn't that important? And but it was also funny because people were talking about how RT is all Russian propaganda. And I'm like, yeah, because Tom Hartman, who had a show on there, and Jesse Ventura and Larry King are all Russian propagandists. You know, it's the people, like you said, people, if you just did a little bit of work of, instead of taking somebody's word for it and researching a little bit yourself, it's amazing that you'd be like, okay, well, obviously this can't all be just Russian propaganda, because there's people that I trust or people that have a history of being somewhat trustworthy on this channel, and maybe I won't go to RT for my Russian news, but if I want some good American news, absolutely. If I want some good news on, you know, maybe I won't go to BBC on what's going on in the UK, but maybe in the rest of the world. Same thing with Al Jazeera and all these other outlets. So I completely agree with you. That's always been my technique. And it's the U.S. has interests in molding the public's perception on what's going on, because they want to go to a certain war. They want a conflict or whatnot. And I think the Syria thing was when the U.S. population actually said no, and they're like, no, we don't want to go to Syria the first time. And I think it was a great we won. And it's like, wow, this is awesome. But it shows the power of propaganda and the power of just, you know, finding some other tricks. And then you had the chemical weapons, and then you had, you know, they found some other way in getting involved. And if you talk to the average American and you say, hey, can Syria be a threat to us? Like you talked about earlier about, you know, defense. Is Syria an actual threat to us? Is Iran an actual threat to us? Is it, you know, do we need to be involved in these conflicts? Are they an actual threat to us, where if we don't get involved, we're all at risk? Most people will sit back and be like, no, you're right. They probably can't, right? You know, and it's like, no, they can't. You know, they're more of a threat to the countries surrounding them than they are us. And we're the ones pushing all this and you know, using our proxy wars in Yemen and all this other stuff, causing all this mess and probably on purpose.
And the idea of Syria or some other country finding someone to set off a bomb in Cleveland, as crazy as that is, it's far more credible than what people usually tell me, which is that Syria is threatening to take away their freedoms. Like Syria is going to occupy the United States, take over the Congress, and somehow, you know, legalize warrantless spying or torture or lawless imprisonment or, oh, wait a minute, they already did that. You know, the freedoms disappear with the wars. There's not this threat that the war enemies are going to somehow take away your freedoms. No one's even spelled out what that means, what that looks like, how it happens. It's ridiculous. But I do think that when something like Russia television you know, has a Russian bias and it likes to tell stories that make the United States look bad and so forth. It's doing the United States a favor to tell the U.S. public about things that are going bad in the United States. That's not attacking the United States. That's helping us make the United States better. Just as whoever leaked or hacked the emails that showed us what the Democratic Party was up to during its primary was a favor to the United States. It's helping democracy to find out what I don't think anybody in Russia had the slightest thing to do with it. But if they did, I would thank them for it. And I think you're right that that it was very encouraging in 2013 that people said, no, we don't want to bomb Syria. We don't want a war. And I think what was most effective in the propaganda that turned people around was ISIS videos, was videos of people having their necks cut with knives, which is just far more horrible than nuclear bombs that kill millions of people, you know, because it scares people more. It scared people so much. They said in 2014 and ever since, go ahead and get in the war in Syria. As a matter of fact, get in on both sides, which is what the U.S. government has done. You know, and the proposal just recently that the U.S. should stick to one side of that war, you know, has been treated as outrageous and scandalous. But normally that would make sense to most people.
Well, and the other thing, it's amazing how little people know about history when they talk about the Russians getting involved in our elections, but yet we're involved in the protests in Ukraine. We're involved in a lot of people believe we're involved in the protests in Iran. You know, we were involved with Nicaragua and all the Central American countries when we're funneling our money and weapons to the coups, and at the School of Americas when we're actually training these guys, and like all this stuff. It's like we've been involved with getting in other countries' politics forever. So the fact that people are outraged that, like, maybe even if there was a hint of truth where the Russians did have something to do with the email leak, and even if that was the case, it's like, okay, it's not like they made fake emails. They only exposed something that actually existed in the first place. So and I mean, if the IP address went to somebody who lived in Russia, could you blame the whole country anyways, you know? So
yeah, I think if there were any truth to the idea that Vladimir Putin organized the hacking of the U.S. election, we would have seen it by now. I mean, you have had all government resources, all Democratic Party resources, all liberal resources, the CIA, the FBI, putting over a year into this thing, coming up empty. There is nothing there to be found. The idea is ridiculous. I mean, of course, they're going to find all kinds of scandals and money laundering and corruption, and they've already found the U.S. Colluding with Israel, trying to get Russia and Egypt and other governments to oppose what was U.S. policy, you know, when President-elect Trump opposed Obama's position on U.N. resolutions on Israel. But, you know, they'll find lots of stuff, but they're not going to find that. They're not going to find that Putin stole a U.S. election. And if they did, I would take it very, very seriously. I would consider that a huge story and an outrageous crime. But I would also consider the many, many dozens of such actions by the United States around the world, many of them quite open, you know, to be just as outrageous. I mean, Obama making videos for a candidate in the French presidential election while all of his buddies are denouncing Putin for stealing a U.S. election. I mean, that sort of hypocrisy, that sort of double standard. If you go to davidswanson.org, at the top, there's a link that says war list, and you click it, and it gives a list of dozens and dozens of interfering with elections, assassinating foreign leaders, overthrowing foreign governments, bombing foreign countries. I mean, it's voluminous. I mean, it's standard routine procedure. The president of Honduras is not elected. He's supported by thugs, including the United States State Department. That, you know, that would be unacceptable to the U.S. government if some U.S. enemy tried it.
There was an app that I had a while ago called, I think it was like Metadata, where you could actually see the drone strikes that the U.S. were doing every day or every couple of days whenever they would do it. And they would, it would look like Google Maps, and it would give you a description of who died, how many people died, and where the location was, where the drone attack was. And, you know, I downloaded it, and I'm just like keeping up with this, and I'm like, holy shit. Like, every single time one of these attacks happen, you know, you see like, you know, one child, one woman or whatever. And it's like we're creating terrorists as we speak. Like whoever survived is a terrorist. Just like if somebody bombed my house right now and killed my wife and kids, and then, you know, and then some terrorist group came in and said, hey, do you want to be recruited into this this group that's fighting the people who killed your family? I'd be like, hell yeah, I do. You know, absolutely. Because my life goal would be to get revenge for killing my family. So like you're saying, it's much easier to see things, and maybe this is a human problem, to see things from our perspective than other people's perspective. But I mean, when you look at what happened in Iraq, and there's a great documentary, Iraq for Sale, which made everything even worse because you end up just seeing how much of our taxpayer money went to it, never mind the lives and people who have PTSD. And I mean, my wife has a cousin who just got recently in trouble because he's mentally, like, he's fine, and then mentally he's, you know, and this kid will never get his life back. He'll never be normal again because, you know, and he's on disability, but he tries to get a job just to have some type of normalcy in his life, and eventually he'll just disappear and on this alcohol binge. And this, I'm like, mentally this kid will never be normal again. And all we say about the war is like, oops, we messed up, maybe we shouldn't have went there. It's like, it's so sad. And it's, you know, and like that statistic, what is it, like 3 out of 5 homeless people are a veteran. I mean, we should be ashamed of these things. And the fact that we go on with our lives like, you know, like, oh, no big deal. And then we continuously make the same mistakes, which is always the saddest part of it, is that how, you know, when we went to Iraq, after looking back at it, after, you know, a lot was said and done, we're like, yeah, we messed up. We shouldn't have been there. And then we're okay with, like, killing Gaddafi, and now that's a mess, you know. And then we're okay with getting involved in Syria and Iran. Oh, Iran's a threat. We got to get involved. You know, it's like, how many times are we going to keep making the same mistake until we realize that, you know, maybe we shouldn't be involved in any of these. But isn't that the issue? The issue is that these are just what the reasons they're telling us that they're getting involved for human rights issues, even though our allies are Saudi Arabia, who stone women publicly, you know. What do you, you know, you've studied this and you obviously keep track of what's going on in the world much closer than I do. Why do you think we're so involved in Syria and Iran, and those two are the hot button issues at the moment?
Well, I'm not, but the U.S. military and the CIA are. And if you look at a map of that region of the globe, as I did at this conference this past weekend, that you can go look at noforeignbases.org. This was a conference organized around closing U.S. foreign military bases. And you color the countries on that map. If they have U.S. military bases in them, which countries don't get colored? Apart from Yemen, which is being demolished and is just the greatest horror we've seen in recent years in terms of famine and starvation and cholera and utter devastation, Iran and Syria. That's it, Iran and Syria. Iran is surrounded on all sides, including in the water, by U.S. troops and U.S. bases. Syria as well. These spots on the globe that stand out are spots that oppose U.S. domination. When I watch a basketball game, you know, two things are guaranteed to happen. The University of Virginia is guaranteed to win, and they're guaranteed to thank the blessed troops for watching from 175 countries. What are they doing in 175 countries, plus some more that they aren't including in that list? There are about 200 countries on Earth, right? So it's the ones that they're not in. Now, in most of these, it's very small numbers of troops, but in some 80 countries, it's significant bases and growing most rapidly in Africa in terms of the list of countries. But wouldn't 174 be enough? Would you feel safe with 174, maybe 173? How many countries do you have to have U.S. troops in? Well, Syria not only doesn't have a U.S. military base in it, it has a Russian military base in it. So it's, you know, doubly awful, right? Russia has, you know, a dozen or so military bases outside its country. It's in second place to the United States, 800 to 1,000, you know, depending how you count them. This is a U.S. thing. And Iran, of course, since overthrowing its U.S. Dictator in 1979 has been on the hit list, has been, you know, designated enemy of the United States. And it needn't be. And most people in Iran don't want it to be. Most people in the United States would be fine without that, you know, that enemy. But this is how the U.S. government sees things. Other countries are not on that list because they've already come around or been destroyed, like Libya, which was on that list.
And it doesn't it also seem like countries that have nuclear capabilities, those are the ones that were not getting involved? Like, those, it's almost like you need nuclear capabilities, you know, just for a defense mechanism, because it seems like once you, if you're Iraq and you don't have any nuclear weapons, it's like, well, we can easily invade them without any worries. So when you look at a country like Iran or North Korea, I mean, one of the few things that are protecting them is the fact that they have nuclear capabilities, right?
Well, yes and no, and I got to go pretty soon because we're way over time.
Yeah,
but certainly when the United States in the George W. Bush years was threatening North Korea and Iraq, and North Korea quickly developed nuclear weapons, the United States' interest focused entirely on attacking Iraq. And when Libya gave up such weapons, the United States attacked Libya. So the message to North Korea is very clear. Keep your nuclear weapons, or we're going to destroy you. And yet the explicit message that's stated is give up your nuclear weapons or we're going to destroy you. So it's very mixed messages coming from Washington. But I think we ought to be very, very clear that Iran does not have any nuclear weapons, has never had any nuclear weapons, has never had any program to develop any nuclear weapons, has been lied about in that regard for decades, does have nuclear energy. And nuclear energy does put you, you know, relatively close to developing nuclear weapons. And this is a problem in a great many countries, in countries like Saudi Arabia that you don't hear about because they're such good, benevolent, human rights defending friends of the United States. Why are they getting nuclear energy? Because they would like to be within spitting distance of getting nuclear weapons. That's incredibly dangerous and is one of the many reasons we need to abolish nuclear energy. But I think we have to be very, very clear in correcting the corporate media on Iran having nuclear weapons, because it doesn't. It doesn't have any nuclear weapons, and it has more serious inspections of that matter than any other country on earth has ever submitted to.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And when people talk about them getting nuclear capabilities, that's kind of the point I was trying to make, was that it almost, I could see why they would have a reason to want to do that, just because it seems like the countries we don't invade are the ones who do have nuclear weapons. So from their perspective, it's like, well, you know, if we don't want to get invaded, maybe we should look into this. So, you know, again, like I said, it's very easy to see from our perspective, and media does a great job of convincing you that if they do get nuclear weapons, it'd be dangerous and the world would be a more dangerous place. But I think if you live in Iran and you're a resident of the country, you probably look at U.S. foreign policy and you're like, you know what, maybe having nuclear weapons wouldn't be the worst of things for the future of our country. But I won't hold you up anymore, David. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much. I don't think there's enough voices really just pushing this anti-war just narrative, because I think it's the one thing that I think most of us can agree on, and I think it's really important to kind of get this information out there, because I think a lot of people don't know what's going on in the world. They don't know all the proxy wars that are going on, like you mentioned in Yemen and all the things that are going. I'm in Libya. Oh my God! I mean, you talk about the slave trading and all that stuff that's going on right now. It's crazy. And you know, voices like yourself that are really helping people like me keep up with what's going on, I think are very important. I'll put links to your books and your website and all that stuff in the show notes, and people can get to it very easily. Is there anything that you have coming up or promote, anything you'd like to promote?
Go to worldbeyondwar.org and click and sign that you want to end war, and click how you want to get involved, and look at the events page for what's upcoming.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, David. I really, really appreciate it. And I'll hopefully talk to you again in the near future.
Sounds great. Thanks.
Take care. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Okay, you too.
Thanks.
believe in the ripple effect.